Chapter 20.
What are they like, your angels?
Dusan asked her, his face hidden beneath an unblinking golden mask.
To hear their tale tellers, the dark angels are fierce and warlike giants. They walk astride the stars and rain down destruction. Have they come to destroy us? Should we fear them?
There is nothing for you to fear, replied Rhianna Sorrel, inwardly cursing the Calibanite tailspinners and their excesses.
She almost frowned, but she reminded herself that Dusan could see her face, even if she could not see his.
Yes, the Dark Angels make war on the Emperor's enemies, but that does not include the people of Sarosh. You are part of the Imperium. You are our brothers.
That is reassuring, said Dusan.
He turned and gestured to the city with a sweep of his hand.
We have taken such pains to prepare for their arrival to greet them. It would be a tragedy if they had come here to destroy all this. The city is beautiful, is it not? It is worthy of your image, Maker.
It is more than worthy,
she said, holding up the pict recorder she wore on a strap across her shoulder.
With your permission, I'd like to take some picts before the light changes. They'll give me some reference to work from later when I'm composing.
As you wish.
They stood on a balcony overlooking the city of Shalul, planetary capital of Sarosh. It had been nearly 12 months since Rhianna had come to Sarosh, but in that time she had rarely been allowed to journey to the planet's surface. Despite the amicable attitude of the local people and the apparent benevolence of their culture, officially this world was not yet compliant. It was clear that the Imperial commanders were loath to let civilians down to the planet any more than they had to, though Rhianna suspected that the leaders of the Astartes had played at least some role in blocking civilian requests for access. She had no idea if the situation was the same in every fleet of the Crusade, but the Astartes with the Fourth seemed to resent any attempt to record native societies in their pre-imperial states. Rhianna was a composer. She had been told that the folk songs of Sarosh were characterized by haunting melodies incorporating the sounds of several traditional types of musical instrument that were unique to this world. But all her information came second-hand, from conversations with Imperial Army troopers who had visited the planet more regularly than she had. So far, she had heard nothing of Sarosh's music herself. She had some idea in mind of a symphony combining Saroshi folk melodies with the bombastic musical forms that were currently the height of fashion in the Imperium. Until she heard the melodies, however, she had no way of knowing whether the idea was viable. For the moment, she satisfied herself by taking pics of the city in search of inspiration. Dusan was right. It was beautiful. The sun was setting, and in response to the imminent fall of night, the city began to show itself in its most alluring aspect as the glow globes were lit. Unlike other cities, Shalul did not possess any form of communal street lighting system. Instead, by order of the city fathers, the inhabitants were furnished with 3 floating glow globes each to light their way whenever they left their houses. Man, woman, or child, every citizen of Shalul was accompanied by the bright hovering globes when they went outside. The effect from Rhianna's vantage on the balcony, as thousands of people walked to the city's eateries and drinking places or simply stepped out for an evening stroll, was astonishing. The entire city appeared to be alive with distant bobbing points of floating light, like a gently eddying sea of earthbound stars. It was extraordinary, but it was only one of the city's diverse wonders. In contrast to many of the other settlements she'd seen, whether on Terra or elsewhere in the galaxy, Shalul was not crowded. It was a city of open horizons, nor was it dirty. From the first instant she laid eyes on it, it was plain that Shalul was a city designed for ease of living. It was a place of wide boulevards and broad public spaces, of parks and greenery, of inspiring monuments and grand palaces. Rhianna was accustomed to hive cities, to the press and squalor of hab life, to every dwelling being built in uncomfortably close proximity to its neighbours. Shalul couldn't have been more different. It seemed a kinder, more contented place than any she'd known before. The Saroshi claimed their society had not known war for more than 1,000 years, and certainly the architecture of their cities indicated nothing to disprove their claims. No walls enclosed the city's perimeter, and she had seen no obvious defences or fortifications. On the few brief occasions when she'd been given permission to visit the city, Rhianna had experienced none of the vague unease and nebulous sense of menace she usually felt when she explored the streets of an unknown city for the first time. The streets of Sarosh felt safe and secure. Perhaps it was the harmonious, well-ordered nature of Saroshi society that caused the Astartes to look with suspicion on any attempts to record it. To all intents and purposes, the city of Shalul appeared to be a perfect place to live. So did the rest of Sarosh, for that matter. Perhaps the Astartes feared the comparisons that would inevitably be made between the past and the present once the Imperium was granted its wish and the planet was made compliant. It occurred to her that these were curious thoughts. She was as much a servant of the Imperium as the Astartes, yet she found herself almost doubting her mission. These people appeared perfectly happy with their lives. What right did they have to change them? It was the city, she told herself. The place was bewitching. It wasn't just the floating lights and the architecture. It was everything about it. The walls on either side of the balcony they were standing on were covered in a climbing plant with lustrous green-black leaves and brilliant purple flowers. It produced a heady scent, an intoxicating musk that mixed with the night air and seemed to have a calming, restive quality. It was easy to think of this world as paradise.
You are content?
Desan asked her.
Content?
He pointed to the pict recorder in her hands.
You have stopped operating your machine. You have all that you need?
I have, she said. But this machine records more than images. It can also record sound. I had hoped to hear some examples of your music.
My music?
It was impossible to see Dusan's face beneath the mask, but the questioning note in his voice was obvious, as was his unfamiliarity with the grammatical forms of Gothic.
This is a metaphor, perhaps. I am not a musician.
I meant the music of your culture, explained Rhianna. I've been told it is exquisite. I was hoping to hear some.
There will be musicians at the festival tonight, said Dusan. In celebration of the Dark Angel's arrival, our leaders have decreed a planet-wide holiday. I am sure you will hear music worthy of recording once we join the celebrations. Does this news please you?
Yes, it pleases me, answered Rhianna.
She had noticed there tended to be a stilted quality to conversations with the Saroshi as they grappled with the nuances of a newly learned language. On some worlds visited by the Crusade, there had been an adverse reaction among the local inhabitants when they were told that the Imperium expected them to learn Gothic and use it in all government business. On Sarosh, though, they had warmly embraced the official Imperial language. Rhianna had already seen a few street signs on Shalul written in Gothic, and she'd been told that some of the great works of Saroshi literature were in the process of being translated. It was another sign of the goodwill the local people had shown to the Imperium from the arrival of the first Imperial ships in orbit around their planet. Again, it brought home to her just how ridiculous the current situation was. Despite the warmth with which Saroshi society had greeted the Imperium, their planet had so far been denied the certification of compliance. She had heard much muttering on fleet ships about Saroshi's bureaucracy, but it seemed to her that Imperial bureaucracy was every bit as invidious. Time and again, the Saroshi had shown they were a friendly and peaceful people, eager to take up their place in the broader brotherhood of humanity. How could anyone find reasons to distrust them? Don't trust them, Kyrgis had told him. After less than a day spent in orbit around the planet of Sarosh, Zahariel felt there was every indication that the White Scar had given him good advice about its people. He did not have any evidence to confirm it. It was more a gut feeling, a presentiment born of his awakening psychic potential. If Zahariel had been called upon to give his opinion of the Saroshi, he could have cited precious little in the way of precedent to explain his distrust. Ordinarily, he was inclined to be trusting. He was an honourable man, and it was one of his flaws that he occasionally fell into the trap of believing that everyone else was as honourable as he was. Nemiel was the one with a suspicious mind, forever questioning the motives of those around him. Zahariel took individuals as he found them. He had a soldier's innate dislike of hypocrisy and double talk, yet with nothing to support his reaction, he found he distrusted the Saroshi from the moment he met them. Perhaps it was the masks that did it. It was the cultural norm for all adults and children on Sarosh to continually wear masks. Excepting their most intimate and private moments, the Saroshi went masked at all times, not just in public but in their homes as well. Zahariel had heard tell of many surprising customs among the peoples of rediscovered worlds, but the Saroshi practice of mask-wearing was easily the most remarkable he had encountered. The masks were rigid and made of gold, covering the wearer's face entirely, but not the ears or the rest of the head. Each mask was shaped to show the same handsome and stylized facial features, identical for both men and women. They reminded Zahariel of the ceramic death masks created in some cultures, cast from the faces of the recently deceased. He had always found such death masks to have a sense of emptiness about them. They recorded the dimensions and features of the face in question, but after death they were unable to record the true nature of their subject. There was something vital missing, a lack of expression and detail that reduced the death mask almost to the level of caricature. It was the same with the masks of Sarosh. Zahariel was sure that a poet would probably find some manner of poetic metaphor in the fact that the Saroshi confronted life from behind a mask. But he saw only a culture accustomed to keeping things hidden. Zahariel was no poet, but he understood that the face was an essential tool of human communication. It revealed its owner's thoughts and moods by a thousand minute signs. In communicating with the Saroshi, however, the Imperium was denied this source of information and was forced to make do with blank, permanently smiling facades. No wonder there had been such difficulty in bringing their world to compliance. Then there was the question of criminal justice on Sarosh, or rather, the lack of it. Again, Kyrgis had brought the matter to his attention. "They have no prisons," the White Scar had said to him during their meeting after the exchange of commands. "One of the surveyors noticed it as he was checking over the aerial pics of Shalul. She checked through the maps of every other settlement on Sarosh and found the same thing. No prisons, nor anywhere else where prisoners could be kept."
"Not every culture imprisons its criminals," said Zahariel.
"True," nodded Kyrgis. "We didn't on Chogoris. In the old days before the Imperium came, we followed Plains law. It was a harsh code in keeping with the landscape. A man who committed a crime might be punished by being stoned to death, or we might hamstring him, or leave him to die in the wilderness without water, food, or weapons. If he had murdered another man, he might be enslaved and forced to serve the dead man's family for a number of years until he had worked off the blood debt. But the Saroshi consider themselves a civilized culture. In my experience, civilized men don't like their justice kept so simple. They like to complicate things."
"Did anyone ask the Saroshi for an explanation?"
"According to the Saroshi, crime is rare on their world. When a crime is committed, they punish the criminal by making him work more hours in their bureaucratic service."
"Even the murderers?" frowned Zahariel. "That sounds unlikely."
"There's something else. As part of the process of compliance, the calculus logi with the fleet asked to see the census data from Sarosh for the last decade. I have no head for figures, brother, but something I heard when the logi reported back to the fleet strategium has stayed with me. Based on the planet's birth rate and the number of deaths recorded in the census, it is estimated that the population on Sarosh should be much bigger than the figure the Saroshi have reported back to us. When asked about this, the Saroshi government claimed the census data must be in error."
"What kind of figure are we talking about?" Zahariel asked him.
8%, Kyrgis told him. "Put that way, it doesn't sound much, I know. But if the calculations are right, it means more than 70 million people have disappeared on Sarosh in the course of the last 10 years.
It was a wonderful night. As Rihanna walked the streets and passages of the city of Shalul, she marvelled at the extraordinary sights she saw all around her. The festival Dusan had spoken of earlier was in full swing. The streets were crowded with masked revellers, the roadways made vibrant with colour as legions of lithe dancers swathed rhythmically along in outlandish costumes, trailing swooping kites and long paper streamers behind them. She saw jugglers and painted clowns, contortionists and sleight-of-handers, mummers and mimics, tumblers and acrobats. She saw giants on stilts, sword-devourers and men breathing fire. And above it all, she heard the music. Strange sounds drifted to her from across the carnival throng. The songs of Sarosh were beautiful, yet perplexing. They switched mood constantly, alternating between complex patterns of harmony and discord, expressing conflicting emotions of sorrow and joy, without warning. She heard musical notes and key changes she never even knew existed, as though some special quality of the music had broadened the range of her hearing. Underlying it all, almost hidden, were the most startling rhythmic variations she had heard in her life. Listening to the sounds of Sarosh, Rihanna understood for the first time just how perfect and splendid music could be. She had trained her entire life as a composer, but nothing she had written could compare to the astonishing sounds she heard echoing through these streets. It was an experience as heady in its own way as the perfume of the flowers had been on the balcony. Dusan was beside her, his hand at her elbow, leading her through the crowds. Earlier in the day, when Rihanna had made landfall, they were told that the Saroshi authorities had assigned them each a guide to ensure they would not get lost. She supposed Dusan was intended to serve as her minder as much as anything else, following forever close at hand to keep her out of trouble. Initially, when they met, she had asked him what he did for a living. He had told her he was an exegetist. As she understood it, he was a professional explainer. Due to the scale of bureaucracy on Sarosh, it was not uncommon for even relatively trivial matters of governance to become fiendishly complicated, as dozens of bureaucrats had their say on the issue, each with a different interpretation of the planet's statutes. These situations sometimes escalated to long-running disputes, lasting up to 20 years or more, long after all those involved in it had forgotten the question that had initially triggered the impasse. In such occurrences, an exegetist was hired to research the causes of the dispute and explain it to the contesting parties to ensure they fully understood it. It was a curious system, but whatever the Byzantine complexity of local custom, Rihanna had suffered far less convivial escorts in the past. In the initial months of the imperial presence, on the few occasions she had been granted permission to explore Sarosh, she had been accompanied by a half-squad of imperial army troopers, stalking her steps like bored and ill-tempered shadows. It had been embarrassing, not to mention difficult to establish a rapport with the local people, when a fire team of heavily armed men lurked just over your shoulder. Thankfully, in recent months, at the urging of Lord Governor-elect First, the fleet had adopted a more enlightened approach. The planet of Sarosh might not be officially 100% compliant, but it had been decided it was safe enough to permit Imperial personnel to walk about on their own without requiring a full military escort. At the same time, in the hope of building bridges between the locals and the Imperials, army and fleet commanders had begun to allow more of their men to visit Sarosh on shore leave.
"This way," said Dusan.
At some point in the night, he had begun to steer her through the streets as though he had a specific destination in mind. His grip on her elbow had grown tighter, but she found she hardly noticed. Drunk on the music and the scent of purple flowers, she let him lead.
"Where are we going?" she asked him, dimly perceiving that her words sounded slurred.
"There is a place where they make better music," he said from behind his mask. "It is just a little further."
He began to walk faster, his hold on her arm forcing her to hurry her pace to keep up with him. Looking around, Rihanna became suddenly aware that they had left the main boulevards behind for a series of twisting, narrow alleyways. It was dark. The glow globes that had once floated above their heads had abandoned them, staying behind at some distant corner. They were alone in the night, the only light coming from the silver sickle of the moon high overhead. Despite the darkness, Dusan did not miss a step. He seemed to know exactly where they were heading.
"Dusan, I don't like this."
She found it harder to speak. Her tongue felt numb.
I want you to take me back."
He did not answer. No longer in the humour to explain anything, he dragged her through the alleyways as a creeping paralysis spread through her limbs. She realised he had poisoned her somehow. The air was heavy with the scent of flowers. Flowers, perhaps that was how he did it. She was staggering, barely able to keep her feet, even less able to fight him.
"Dusan!"
Her words sounded distant and hollow.
"Why?"
"I am sorry. It is the only way. The Melakim have decreed you are an unclean people. Your lyre angels must not be allowed to pollute us. You will be our weapon against them, and there will be pain, I am afraid. It seems cruel, I know, but be assured, you serve a higher purpose."
They turned a corner into a courtyard. Ahead, Rihanna could see a handcart of the kind used to sell bottled drinks to the carnival revellers. Two figures stood by the side of it, wearing baggy, multicoloured costumes covered in dangling knots and ribbons. Seeing them, Dusan released his hold, allowing Rihanna's body to fall unceremoniously onto the cobbled surface of the courtyard. She heard him snap out orders in his native tongue, and then she saw the two figures advance towards her. There was something wrong in the way they moved. Whoever had made their costumes had tried to cover it, but Rihanna could see it clearly. They walked with an odd sideways gait, their knees and ankles flexing at peculiar angles. Their mannerisms put her in mind of the movements of reptiles. There was something unnatural about them. The closer they came, the more she became convinced they were inhuman. Paralysed, she could only watch as they drew nearer and looked down upon her. As the two strange clownish figures bent forward to lift her between them, Rihanna saw the mask on one of them slip for a moment. She saw his true face. Despite her paralysis, she screamed.